Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike. It's good to have you. Today we are benefited by having a master coach with us named David Taylor Klaus. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dr. Mike. I'm excited to see where we go today.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Great to have you. I see that you do a lot of entrepreneurial and executive coaching, and I love a quote that you have from Viktor Frankl that our power to choose our attitude and to choose what I would call a reverent attitude towards life is one of the last great powers that we have. What a great thing to have on your website when it comes to coaching. That's fantastic.
Well, you know, dirty secret, I'm keeping that quote by having it on the website in front of me so I remember. It's a brilliant structure for me and my ADD that I get to stay current with the understanding that I am ultimately in control of the way I experience the world. And his is a great reminder for that.
Oh, it's such a brilliant, brilliant teaching, such a wise teaching. So let's start by telling us, tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and the kind of work that you do.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, my favorite way to describe what I do is that I reintroduce successful entrepreneurs to their families.
I saw that. And, yeah.
So let me ask you, how did that land? What came up when you read it?
Well, you know, I love that in the sense of, you know, when people get in. So the way I think about this, David, is that really there's four dimensions of human vitality that all interact and support each other. And those four dimensions are work, love, play, and health. And as the dynamic living systems, we need to really, for example, keep our vitality by sleeping and exercising and eating well. And then play is so important for a successful entrepreneur to be able to go out and play. The most productive people are the ones who play the most. And also love sustains us. So having loving connections to family and friends is critical if you want to be successful in your work as an entrepreneur. That was the way I read that.
Well, it's actually spot on. And it's interesting. I love that I get to use that phrase for two reasons. One, it captures it for me in reality, the truth of what I do. And number two, it's because each person who hears it has a different experience of it. And love looking at it through the lens of those four aspects of vitality, you know, work, love, play, and health, because that's the audience that I've been serving since 2008 is exactly who I was before, which is that over-calibrated leader where those four pistons were not firing well. My work piston was hauling ass, but the love, the play, and the health, no, not really. I was over-calibrated towards work for whatever the unwritten rules were that was in my head, they had me totally over-calibrated, off balance, out of rhythm.
And it's almost like a work addiction, right?
Kind of like yeah, that? Yes. It wasn't even elegant enough to be an addiction. It was, oh, God, it was full-on unconscious obsession. I wasn't even getting the joy out of the rush of using anymore.
I don't know about you, but you know, in my own life, I had kind of an awakening experience, David, when I was about 52. I had just won my second top doctoral award in New Hampshire, and you would think that would be a great thing, right? But after winning it the second time, the joy of that kind of left me, and I looked at my life, and I was like, I was overworking. I was working 6 days a week and a couple of evenings, and not investing any time in personal relationships. I was overweight. I felt a little bit depressed. And I kind of had this awakening that I subsequently later understood. I didn't understand it at the time, but I subsequently understood that I had been an over-calibrated worker, if you will, because I had the idea that if I was to be successful in achievement, that would make me lovable. That was what would make me a lovable, worthy person, was whether or not I was achieving well at work. And I wonder if you see that unconscious sort of work as a worthiness project. Do you see that at all in the work you do with the people you coach?
I do, and not to step out of the coach lane into the psychiatry and psychology lane. You know, that's where my degree was initially. But it's the see that it is most often the worthiness game of proving oneself to a parent or to someone who is no longer a direct control of their world. It's not even as much to themselves. Underneath it all, it's trying to prove it to someone else.
That's brilliant. That was my case. I thought that I would get my mom's love by being a high achiever. Absolutely.
But yeah, the challenge is, and it may be similar for you, I was just teetering on 40 when this happened. I was also, you know, eating at my desk more often than at home. I knew the kids played sports. I just didn't know when or where. And my wife hated my company more than I did. And those were the hallmarks that I was doing something wrong.
Yeah.
Right?
And how did you turn that around? I mean, you were in pain about that, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, I did that for a little while. The gap between realizing that I was in that triggered state and when I chose something different, I'd like to say that was a narrow gap. That may have been about a year of conscious awareness, which just amplifies the pain and discomfort, right? Because now I'm aware of why I feel crappy.
Yeah.
And I also know that it's all me and my fault that I'm feeling crappy. So that took a little extra. That really is, and I think that's very common for entrepreneurs. They become aware, but they believe they're doing well enough, right? I got to Hurricane Katrina weekend, and, you know, by coincidence, the storm is barreling up on the center of the country, and the storm inside me was welling up as well. And I got to my bottom. That was my almost literally a jumping off the bridge point.
Oh, really?
And,
wow.
Oh, yeah. I had gotten so disconnected from what was important, I couldn't identify a reason to stay for me. And I got lucky. I had learned something about, through the Hemingway family story, Ernest Hemingway and his children, that the research had surfaced that children of parents who have committed suicide are 50 times more likely to attempt it in their lifetime. And what kept me from jumping was exactly that. That wasn't the legacy I wanted for my children. What I wanted for them was learning to love themselves and each other and to be part of this world. And I had gotten so disconnected that I couldn't anymore, but I could change it for them. That's what got me to stay.
Oh, you really wanted to do this differently as a gift to your children.
Absolutely. I got around to it being for me as well.
Yeah.
I had to start with something.
Right, right. And children are a real source of inspiration for committing to a life of love, right?
Absolutely. Well, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis described children as the paparazzi. She said, they see everything, they hear everything, and they repeat it at the worst possible time. So I know they're learning from everything I was doing, and I didn't like what I was teaching them.
So you had a bottom moment where you lived with this pain for about a year, and it got worse and worse, and you were aware of it. You were aware that you were your way of being in the world, was not working for you. But then you had sort of an awakening, and how did you turn that around? Because I see that you woke up to really really wanting to live to love your family. It sounds like that was the shift for you from working. Is that right?
It was, and I think the steps I took, all of them, you know, each person is going to do it a different way, but all of the steps involve reaching outside of yourself for help. Being an entrepreneur and being a leader, it can be very isolating. And when you get into this, you know, soul-sucking hell spot, it's even more isolating. So for me, it started with therapy, and then it moved on to coaching in addition and from there. And when I witnessed what was happening with coaching for me, trying to look at it objectively, making a huge difference in the way I saw the world. And as soon as each time I changed my lens through which I looked at the world, my experience of the world changed. So we are evidence collecting machines. So whatever lens we put on the world, right, we're going to call it confirmation bias. We're going to see everything that happens through that lens, and therefore that's going to color our experience. So if I see through a lens that I am loved or I am lovable, then I will collect evidence to prove that. And so when we change our lens, we change our lives.
I love that. I love that. And it's so true. What allowed you to take on that lens of I am loved and I am lovable?
Repeatedly having that message hammered into me by people around me.
So you were able to take the love of others to help you.
Yes. And I the real gift is my wife started becoming a coach. And I watched what happened to her and who she was becoming and how she was unleashing. And I had two immediate thoughts. One was, wow, I want some of that for me, right? You know, my fear of missing out is clinical. And so I really wanted to experience some of that. And then I also realized, whoa, she's going to outgrow me and quickly. And Elaine and I have been together now 29 years. It's because we are both at heart growers, not status quoers. And so, you know, couples like that are constantly growing and, you know, outgrowing each other, catching up, etc. Well, I was noticing a huge gap, and it was time for me to get my together. I went to the first weekend at coach training and was blown away. I was like, holy moly, now there's language and structure and discipline and tools in a profession around the way I had always done my consulting work. This is cool stuff. And that led me into now 13 years into being a professional coach.
Now, David, you are a very talented person and very, very gifted. And you've written a book called Mindset Monday, 52 Ways to Rewire Your Thinking and Transform Your Life. I'd love to hear more about that book and some of the – and maybe really use our time together to really maybe do some teaching to our audience about some of your wisdom.
The book – I was challenged by a coach of mine to – write the book that I needed to read. And so this is the book that when I was 14 and first realized that I was navigating depression, I needed. When I was 39 and ready to jump, this would have changed my world. When I started any of my companies, this book would have changed my world, because this is written to give folk the reins. The quote that I share in the introduction is that it was credited to Carl Jung. It says, we do not see the world as it is. We see the world as we are. So our view colors our experience.
Right. Yeah. I don't think Carl Jung was the one who said that, but
No, it came from the Talmud originally.
It's part of that confirmation bias. It's really true. We see the world as according to who we are. That's so true. That's a great lesson, and one of the things you've already taught us is that one of the ways that we can get in touch with our lovability is to take in the love of other people, and you were able to do that from your wife and your coaches, and I'm sure you probably had friends that you opened yourself up to do that.
Yeah, and part of it is opening yourself up to receive love from yourself. I think one of the things that the last relationship we put our attention on is the one that should be the first for us to heal and nurture, and that's the relationship with ourselves. And one of my favorite pieces in this book, chapter 17, is called Words Create Worlds. And it really speaks to how much our language, the words that we use, change relationships. You know, our primitive brain, that reptilian piece that we all share, has very few modes that it can operate in, right? Fight, flight, freeze, fawn, make babies. There are not a lot of things that it really is wired to do. So when we say things that are locked and binary, we process that as truth. So when I say, oh, I'm terrible at, you know, strategic planning, right? Or I'm terrible at, I don't know, Dr. Mike, what's one thing you don't feel like you're good at?
Let's see. oh, boy, cooking.
Right. So when you say, I'm terrible at cooking, right, your brain picks that up. Your primitive brain picks that up as a hard-locked truth. Right? And therefore, you know, the prefrontal cortex, the more modern brain responds to that by attaching language to it and holding that as a truth. Well, here's the thing.
Right.
That'll make it that way forever. As opposed to, you know what? I'm not that good at, up until now, I haven't been very good at cooking. It's opening up the possibility for change. If you do not, you can't simultaneously prepare for something while believing that it can't happen. And so your language causes a block. Up until now, I haven't been very good at cooking, or I'm not good at cooking yet. Simple changes in language open up the possibility for change, and good God, that's all our brains need to create change.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's sort of a, you know, I remember Wayne Dyer writing a book, you'll see it when you believe it, right? And the, mm-hmm. the power of beliefs to look very carefully. In my model of the three A's of awakening, attending, appreciating, and acting with love, that there's that attending, and what you're raising here is the idea of attending and inquiring and looking deeply at the kind of beliefs that we have or the kind of things that we tell ourselves about ourselves and others, right? And you're opening up a way of really looking at those beliefs and maybe relanguaging those to be more open and hopeful, it sounds like.
And the relanguaging can make such a difference because, you know, it's the simple actions repeated with frequency that make for the greatest change. You don't have to make a 90-degree turn. It's just these small changes that you keep playing out. One of the things I built into this book is a framework called Rewire. And it's designed to help people actually take the learning from these chapters and take it out in their world and make it real. It's a structured approach for integrating and reinforcing new ways of thinking, being, and doing, right?
I and love that. Rewire
is just an acronym, right? And at the end of each chapter, there are six steps customized for that chapter based on the Rewire framework, and it's reflect, experiment, write, investigate, revise, and expand. And it takes the reader through that chance to reflect, an experiment they can use to take that new mindset or that new way of thinking out into the world, and then to write about it. I've even got a journaling page for each of the chapters in the book, so you have very few excuses, right? Oh, and by the way, and you can throw some other neuroscience behind this as well, that the framework is rewire, not retire, because this isn't type. This is write. Our brains process differently when we use our hand to write things than when we type.
Oh, yes. Writing out longhand in an old-fashioned written journal is a way of integrating the sense. Yeah. So six steps. I want to go through. Reflect. So what you did when you had your first initial awakening experience, and then you talk about experimenting and then writing about your experiments.
Investigating what surfaced as you did the journaling, because this is not edited journaling. This is stream of consciousness, write and capture everything that's surfacing. And then, mm-hmm. you know, play the fascinated anthropologist and look at what you've written, look at what's come up, and then revise the experiment. Take it back out into your world. You play that again. And then the part that really drives it home is the expand piece, because now you're taking the learning, the mindset that you've taken out into the world, and you're applying that learning to another area of your world. When we use it again, it has a better chance of sticking. The whole goal of this is to make for meaningful, lasting change, not just a cool thing to play with in your head while you read the book and then put the book back on the shelf and go about your life.
Absolutely, yeah. This is great. I love this methodology. Can you give me an example? Maybe we could talk about a few examples of this six-step process that you have commonly come across, either with yourself or with some of your clients.
Well, one of the ones. You know, let's stay with the words create worlds, because I actually went through each of these six-step runs for each chapter. Right, the chapters are short. There's I think there's only one that's 1,000 words. The rest are shorter. They're designed to be readily digestible and immediately actionable. So the rewire prompts for that chapter, the reflect exercise is to, what language do you typically use to describe responsibilities, challenges, and dreams? Right? How do your language choices limit or support? And the experiment is, during the week, every time you say, I have to do something, replace it with I get to do or I want to do and see what changes. And then, again, there are 6 steps that go with this. And the idea is that by the end of this, you're stretching to apply your version of I get to in more challenging areas of your life. It's attaching the desire and the gift in doing things to even the most complicated things in your world. Letting go of that I have to find joy in what you're doing.
Oh, that sounds like a great, you talk about management of attitude management, that you're using language to re-language the way that you frame challenges and responsibilities that creates more of a reverent attitude in the sense of being blessed or privileged to be able to do what you're doing in life. I love that it's, you're using language to change your attitude.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, listen, this is great stuff. Let's take a brief break and come right back after the break, David. You're listening to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike and our guest, David Taylor Klaus. And stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike, with our guest, David Taylor Klaus, talking about balancing a productive and rewarding life. David has written a book called Mindset Mondays, 52 Ways to Rewire Your Thinking and Transform Your Life. Welcome back, David.
Glad to be back.
You know, when we first started out, you were talking about how you had a bit of an awakening that you were devoting yourself to your career and neglected family and other realms of functioning. And a lot of your coaching is about helping entrepreneurs and executives to succeed by reintroducing to them their families. And we talked a little bit in the break about work-life balance. And you had mentioned that you have some thoughts and feelings about that phrase. Do you want to share that with us?
Yeah, I mean, just hearing you say it, the hair on the back of my neck stood up again. I'll be incredibly blunt. The idea of work-life balance is killing us. And the challenge is, again, this goes back to our words create our world. I'm not sure whose idea it was to put the word work first in that equation. That captures the essence of what's wrong. I did some search on Google a few years ago, and I set the event search to give me the first 100 results. And I put the phrase life-work balance in quotes. So presumably, I should only get things that had that phrase. 75 of those first 100 results still said work-life balance. Our culture has this so backwards, even Google's algorithm has it backwards. That James Campbell Quick did some research, his professor in Texas, that said that the 70-hour work week has become the standard, and what's left over of our life is being jammed into the cracks and crevices around those 70 hours. That's destructive. And corporate America has come up with this idea of work-life balance, that's saying you can get quality time at home. You don't need quantity time. And you can find that balance. That's actually crap, because in order to balance two things, first you have to separate them. And even before the pandemic, separating work and life was nigh on impossible. So back to, even you're talking about the four pillars of vitality, work, love, play, and health. There are many things in our lives that are important. We have our own personal set of currencies, and we can play with that in a minute. The things that really move us and touch us, family, community, health, travel, play, whatever your list is, those are the things that have relevance and importance in our life. So why put work first, let alone in the phrase at all? right? So what we're really looking at is how do we create a rhythm across all the areas of our life that move us and shape us and fulfill us. So this is really about life rhythm. That's what the game is. That's what we're here to create, and that's how we are successful. So this work-life balance, got it backwards. It's putting entrepreneurs in the grave or the hospital.
You know, it's interesting, David, as you say that, because I've never thought about that term until you brought it up today. Thank you. But really, the term is kind of also messed up in terms of not only in terms of the order, but also this idea that life is something separate from work. Isn't work part of life and play part of life and loving part of life and tending to your health part of life? Aren't those all part of life?
Absolutely.
Wouldn't it want to be something like, I would think maybe love, play, work, or maybe it would be, let's see, health in terms of order of priority. Health, love, play, work, balance.
There you go. I mean, you know, if you're going to name the highlights, the phrase could get kind of long. And
yeah,
notice the order, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Boy, we live in such an out of balance culture where doing and achieving and producing is so much more important, because we have this religion of gross domestic product as and consuming and as sort of our religion in a way, don't you think?
Oh my, yeah, it's become a do to get religion. We do more to get more. And then I
love that.
It's called Parkinson's Law, if I'm not mistaken, and it's that as income increases, your expenses invariably increase, if not exceed, the higher income. And I've got a friend of mine in Canada who's a money coach and only works with people that are making $500,000 a year or more and living paycheck to paycheck.
Oh, I know. What is that about? What's your understanding of that?
Oh, it's filling a gap. You know, the Harvard study that said, you know, once your individual income is over $70,000, there's no appreciable increase in happiness. Oftentimes, there's a decrease. And it's not saying that we shouldn't go out and make money. That's not what this is about. Know what you're making it for. Know what the life is that you want to lead, and let it fund that. Those are the people that are happy. When it's about money, just about money and having more, we do more to get more, and that's exhausting. It is the hamster wheel.
Yes, it really is, and it's sort of like Rapunzel. The more you eat, the more unsatisfying it is, and the greater your appetite for it. And in that way, it really is an addiction, isn't it? It's sort of a way of a do-to-get addiction where You do, and you want, and you get, but it doesn't satisfy. So you do more, and you get more, and it leads you into this exhausting spiral, huh?
Well, you can never have enough of what you don't really need.
Oh, I like that. I like that. Yeah, and what is it that you really need? What is it that they really need underneath this that they're trying to get through work?
We are animals by nature. We just happen to be clothed apes. And as the animals that we are a tribal species. We need connection, right?
Yeah.
And we need intimate, above the neck, intimate connection with other human beings. And it's what we crave. It's where we derive our value and our worthiness and our sense of love and being loved. Being in connection is what we need, and doing more to get more doesn't get us more connected. Oftentimes it gets us less connected, more isolated.
So we believe the message that we received in our culture, kind of a toxic message, that the way to attain value and worthiness is through doing and getting versus through intimate connection, is what you're saying.
Yeah. What we need more of, what we crave more of, and what nurtures us and fills our batteries at the core is connection with other human beings.
Yeah,
even
exactly.
Introverts need it.
Absolutely. So insightful. So, and what a great awakening to sort of reset our life priorities. Very, very helpful. Well, listen, let's take another brief break, David, and we'll be right back after this break. You're listening to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike with our guest, David Taylor Klaus. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Michael McGee, your host, with our wonderful guest, David Taylor Klaus. Welcome back, David.
I'm glad to be here. Let's play.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I take from that you really said something really deeply wise at the end of our last segment was that we derive our value and our worthiness through connection because we are a tribal species rather than maybe through our success and achievements and social status. And so for you with entrepreneurs, I can imagine that they have set up money or sort of a profitability or growth of their companies or whatever as a measure of their success and worthiness. Do you see that with your clients?
Oh, my goodness, I see it all the time. They look at it as, I mean, the running joke is during the era of irrational exuberance, the celebration used to be, oh, my burn rate is X amount, or this is how much we've gotten in seed funding, or in this round or that round, and this is what our valuation is, and it's all about money. Now, I get that. That's a measurement. You know, we tend to look at business as a sport, and the dollars are how you keep score. Fine. The danger is that we end up looking at our value as a human through the same lens. The more money I have, the more zeros I have in the bank, the higher my value, the more successful I am. That's the danger. We're measuring by the wrong currency.
I get that. Equating value with wealth. And, you know, I know that we're designed as a tribal species. All primates and actually all animals, mammals, I know, at least, do this. We have a social hierarchy, and we're all unconsciously programmed in terms of who's the best looking, who has the most money, who's the most athletic, who's the most charming, who's the most creative, who's you know, just on and on, who went to the best schools, who's the most intelligent, who's the most talented in whatever area. So we're constantly evaluating each other in terms of where we are on these various social hierarchies, with money being just one of them, and we're equating our value and our worth to being somewhere on that social hierarchy, or one of those social hierarchies in any case. Have you thought much about that?
Yeah, it's one of the measures. You know, there are lots of different ways in which we measure status. We status check, right?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It goes all the way back to primal stages where you had to check, is this person I'm in front of, am I going to kill or be killed? Or is that animal, am I going to eat or am I going to be eaten? So it's constantly evaluating that status check. Well, it's been a long time since we were in imminent danger from a physical threat of the world around us. We're not living in those prehistoric times anymore where we're facing a saber-toothed tiger around every corner. Yet our brains still respond that way. And we've got this agreed-upon fiction, these little stacks of paper that we say have money, have value. We call them money. And when we use that to measure our success, it's dangerous because we have no emotional connection to money, not directly. Our emotional connection to money is, what does it make possible in our lives? Well, follow that path, because the things the money makes possible in our lives are the currencies of success. It's back to what we were talking about in the last segment. It's, you know, family, health, love, play, work, achievement, performance, travel, freedom, whatever your portfolio of currencies are. They're personal and individual to each person. That's the portfolio that you want to see balanced. When we measure our success by money, it's like going to our advisor and saying, put all of my money into Zoom stock, right? Which is great, but that's been up and down 50, 60 bucks every day for the last couple months. So it's volatile, and your advisor would never let you measure and store your wealth in any one security ever. You have to diversify. So same with success. that portfolio of your personal currencies, when you've got a good rhythm there and a good balanced portfolio, that is success. Now, we use money to fund all those things, so it's not that we can say, oh, we don't need money. No, 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 we do. But money serves a purpose. It is not the purpose. And it's important for entrepreneurs to be clear about that. My favorite game to play with an entrepreneur is, how much do you need to make? And usually I get crickets. Like, I don't know. No, no. How much do you need to make? Well, I need to make more. What do you mean you need to make more? How much do you need to make this year or next year? Right? And the reason most of them can't answer it is they don't know what they're making it for. They don't know what the life is they want to lead, and therefore they don't know what that life costs, and they don't know what their business has to throw off for them to have that life, and they don't know what the product and service mix of their company is that will throw off that income for them so they can afford the life that they want to live. And they're making decisions from the wrong perspective. I just need to make more, so I need to scale this company. To what end?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Well, that makes such sense. You know, I think about the trap that, like you said, we're a tribal species, and we all want to be safe, we want to be comfortable, we want to enjoy life, and we want to belong and be valued by our tribe, by our fellow human beings. And people, if they get into this idea that the more money they have, the more valued they'll be, because they'll be higher on that particular social ladder,
pecking order. Yeah,
right. Then that's a mistake in terms of a way to feel valued. But we all fall into the illusion that if we do something that makes us special in some way, we're either the richest or the most talented, or whatever, then somehow that will make us worthy and lovable. And what you're pointing out, David, as I hear it, is just the deep wisdom that it's really through loving and connecting that we experience that sense of our ultimate fulfillment, right?
There's a group of people that I work with that I call impact billionaires. These are folk that are, they're not motivated by the number of dollars they amass. That's not what drives them. What drives them is the number of lives that they can impact, that they can touch. And they're working in areas where the work that they're doing will change the lived experience of a huge swath of the population. These are people that are having a massive impact on the world, driven by and focused on the impact that they have. Now, some of them earn a ridiculous amount of money, and some of them earn just enough. Most of them fall somewhere in between. But the point is, they're driven by the impact that they're having, and these are some of the happiest human beings I have ever met.
Yes, yes. The greatest happiness is in loving and benefiting others. I agree with that. David, we're going to have to close up for today. I want to thank you for being on the show. It's been so good to have you. And I want to point out for people who are listening, they can learn more about David at his website, D as in David, T as in Tom, K as in Klaus, coaching, dtkcoaching.com. And it would be good to check out his book, Mindset Mondays. Is that available on Amazon, David?
It is. Mindset Mondays with DTK is available on every Amazon marketplace right now.
Great. Okay, very good. David, good to have you on the show. Thank you so much. I look forward to continuing our connection.
Been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the How to Live Show with Dr. Mike with our guest, David Taylor Klaus. Stay with me. After the break, I'm going to wrap up today's program. Welcome back to the How to Live Show with Dr. Mike. Great to have David Taylor Klaus on our show. He had a lot of wisdom to offer. Very good stuff. By the way, if you'd like to learn more about me and my work, you can look at my website at howtolove.com, and I will I have some notes there that and some resources for you that can help you. I wanted to sort of focus on what David brought up today in terms of making life a worthiness project by how much money you earn or how successful you are at work, as I did for so many years in my life. I had a patient I've been working with who loves, who's a real talent for quilting, and she loves to quilt, loves to make, to be creative, and she unfortunately has been struggling because she has really said that, you know, when she doesn't do her quilting and when she's not creative in that way, that she feels like she's just not worthwhile. And she says that the way that she experiences her worthiness is through the beauty of the quilts that she makes and her creativity in doing that. But as she brings herself to it, what's happened is her quilting, her creative work, has become a worthiness project for her, as I did in my life with my work, being my worthiness project. And as David, I think, experiences with so many of his clients, who are entrepreneurs in terms of making making money and achieving professionally as a worthiness project. So I wanted to just talk about that and the work that I'm doing with my patient and with other patients who do this. And that's really the work of the first day of attending, which is to look and ask yourself, what is this? What is this? And why is this? What is this? Why is this? And in this case, it's an attending and an inquiry into our motivations. And I think part of awakening to love is really a deep, deep understanding of our motivations. Why are we doing what we're doing? What is this? Why is this? Why am I doing what I'm doing? What are my intentions? What are my motivations? And to look very, very carefully, if you're ever doing anything or saying anything, because somehow you're doing that so that you can feel better about yourself or feel more worthy or feel more lovable. Because when you link your worthiness and your value or your lovability to your performance, if you will, whether it be creativity or making money or whatever, you're really falling into a trap. And when you see that motivation, you really want to see that and clearly let it go. It's almost like renouncing it in a way and giving it up for something better. And what you're giving it up for is the intention. This is a purification of intention. This is acting with love, is purifying our intentions to do things because they benefit us or others, not to make us worthy. It's really a commitment that we are already unconditionally worthy, if you were, in terms of just being inherently part of the universe, whether anybody considers us worthy or not. We want to de-link our value and worth, depending on where we are, on other people's social hierarchies in terms of what they value, and really taking other people's valuing as a measure of our own value. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't care what other people think about us. Not at all. For our survival, it's very important to care deeply about what other people think about us. It's important to treat people well, not just because it feels good to treat people well, but because it's in our best interest to treat people well. But what we want to do is really see that we treat people well for the reasons of benefiting them, but also because it also benefits us as well. So everything we do is out of love. And that is based on the idea that we are already worthy unconditionally. Now, a lot of my patients ask me, well, how do I develop my sense of my worthiness or my lovability? I'm not going to link it to making money or being creative or getting achievements or getting applause. How am I going to tap into my own innate lovability? And I basically have four practices for that. One, David mentioned, is taking in the love of others, that really experiencing our lovability and our worthiness by taking in the other people's experience or treating us with love and validating our unconditional worthiness. Now, this is a little tricky because very few of us are perfectly enlightened or are perfect saints. So the love of others is always mixed with their own sort of selfish motives and concerns, which is part of human. I don't mean that in any negative way, but meaning it only to say that the love of others is imperfect, and people will not love us perfectly all the time. But that is one really key source, is people who are good-hearted and loving and opening ourselves to receive their love and, if you will, borrowing that love and letting it flow into us. I think another practice is visualizing those who have benefited us, and visualizing from a place of meditation, stillness, visualizing their love flowing into our hearts. This is a kind of compassion, kindness, love practice, a visualization practice that is extremely powerful for creating a sense of our unconditional worthiness. It could even be visualizing the love of an ideal figure like Jesus Christ or Buddha or Chen Rezig or the Dalai Lama or Muhammad, some ideal loving figure, and visualizing their love flowing into us. If you do that every day, a little bit every day, consistently, that can really help create a sense of that unconditional goodness. The third practice is the practice of presence. It's getting very, very still so that we see that we are the awareness of our experience and not just our experience, not just our thoughts and feelings, but that there's an awareness, a field of awareness, and realizing in stillness that essence of us, that empty pure awareness of consciousness, that the nature of consciousness, pure consciousness, is loving. We don't have to do anything to experience that except for to have our mind still and in presence experience the loving nature of awareness. That's another, to be able to live from that kind of presence is profoundly transformative. And then the fourth practice would be to see how our judging brains judge good and bad, good and bad, good and bad, and to see with compassion and wisdom that we evolve to judge ourselves and others as good or bad. That's what brains do. They ascribe value to whether something will benefit us or harm us, and we're gooding and badding all the time. But in terms of awakening to love, we need to sort of see that, beyond our arbitrary judgments of what's good or bad, which is different for everybody, that the universe is just as it is, and it's sort of beyond good and bad. It just is what it is. Now, things may be helpful or harmful, so we move from judgment to discernment in this practice. Our brains will still judge. That's what brains do. But we see it, and in the light of our awareness, we let it loosen its hold on us as we move instead from judgment to discernment. Then we find ourselves being less judgmental. So rather than saying, I'm a bad person, or I hate myself, or saying that somebody else is bad, we can maybe move to saying, oh, well, that was unhelpful, or that was harmful, or that wasn't skillful, or oh, what I did was not beneficial to that person. So you're making then judgment, if you will, discernment. I like the word discernment. So the fourth way of really reconnecting with the sense of our innate goodness and unconditional worthiness is to see our judging minds and really let go of the grip of our judging minds and moving consciously from judging to discernment. Where we really move beyond, and I don't have a better word for this, but just a sense that everything is exactly as it must and can only be, and therefore is sacred. It's beyond good and bad, if you will, and to live from that place. That creates a lot of equanimity, and it really creates a freedom so that you can not throw yourself or other people out of your heart when things are painful or destructive or unhelpful. So we'll talk more about this in future shows, but this idea of living life for a worthiness project and renouncing doing anything to become worthy is a really key skill that we need to practice in our lives. So I'll leave you with that. I hope you've enjoyed our show today. This is Dr. Michael McGee, MCGEE. Check me out at howtolove.com. In the meantime, have a great week of love. And we'll see you back next week. Take care.